She is also the president of what is known as the Federation of Southern Colored Women's Clubs and is chairman of the executive committee of the National Federation of Colored Women's Clubs. Portia, the oldest of my three children, has learned dressmaking. She has unusual ability in instrumental music. Aside from her studies at Tuskegee, she has already begun to teach there. Baker Taliaferro is my next oldest child. Young as he is, he has already nearly mastered the brickmason's trade. He began working at this trade when he was quite small, dividing his time between this and classwork. And he has developed great skill in the trade and a fondness for it. He says that he is going to be an architect and brickmason. One of the most satisfactory letters that I have ever received from anyone came to me from Baker last summer. When I left home for the summer, I told him that he must work at his trade half of each day, and that the other half of the day he could spend as he pleased. When I had been away from home 2 weeks, I received the following letter from him. Tuskegee, Alabama. My dear Papa, before you left home, you told me to work at my trade half of each day. I like my work so much that I want to work at my trade all day. Besides, I want to earn all the money I can so that when I go to another school, I shall have money to pay my expenses. Your son, Baker. My youngest child, Ernest Davidson Washington, says that he is going to be a physician. In addition to going to school, where he studies books and his manual training, he regularly spends a portion of his time in the office of our resident physician and has already learned to do many of the duties which pertain to a doctor's office. The thing in my life which brings me the keenest regret is that my work in connection with public affairs keeps me for so much of the time away from my family, where, of all places in the world, I delight to be. I always envy the individual whose life work is so laid that he can spend his evenings at home. I have sometimes thought that people who have this rare privilege do not appreciate it as they should. It is such a rest and relief to get away from crowds of people and handshaking and traveling and get home, even if it be for but a very brief while. Another thing at Tuskegee out of which I get a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction is in the meeting with our students and teachers and their families in the chapel for devotional exercises every evening at 8:30, the last thing before retiring for the night. It is an inspiring sight when one stands on the platform there and sees before him 1,100 or 1,200 earnest young men and women, and one cannot but feel that it is a privilege to help to guide them to a higher and more useful life. In the spring of 1899, there came to me what I might describe as almost the greatest surprise of my life. Some good ladies in Boston arranged a public meeting in the interests of Tuskegee to be held in the Hollis Street Theater. This meeting was attended by large numbers of the best people of Boston of both races. Bishop Lawrence presided. In addition to an address made by myself, Mr. Paul Lawrence Dunbar read from his poems, and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois read an original sketch. Some of those who attended this meeting noticed that I seemed unusually tired, and some little time after the close of the meeting, one of the ladies who had been interested in it asked me in a casual way if I had ever been to Europe. I replied that I never had. She asked me if I had ever thought of going, and I told her no, that it was something entirely beyond me. This conversation soon passed out of my mind, but a few days afterward, I was informed that some friends in Boston, including Mr. Francis J. Garrison, had raised a sum of money sufficient to pay all the expenses of Mrs. Washington and myself during a 3 or 4 months trip to Europe. It was added with emphasis that we must go. A year previous to this, Mr. Garrison had attempted to get me to promise to go to Europe for a summer's rest, with the understanding that he would be responsible for raising the money among his friends for the expenses of the trip. At that time, such a journey seemed so entirely foreign to anything that I should ever be able to undertake that I confess I did not give the matter very serious attention. But later Mr. Garrison joined his efforts to those of the ladies whom I have mentioned, and when their plans were made known to me, Mr. Garrison not only had the route mapped out, but had, I believe, selected the steamer upon which we were to sail. The whole thing was so sudden and so unexpected that I was completely taken off my feet. I had been at work steadily for 18 years in connection with Tuskegee, and I had never thought of anything else but ending my life in that way. Each day the school seemed to depend upon me more largely for its daily expenses, and I told these Boston friends that while I thanked them seriously for their thoughtfulness and generosity, I could not go to Europe for the reason that the school could not live financially while I was absent. They then informed me that Mr. Henry L. Higginson and some other good friends who I know do not want their names made public were then raising a sum of money which would be sufficient to keep the school in operation while I was away. At this point, I was compelled to surrender. Every avenue of escape had been closed. Deep down in my heart, the whole thing seemed more like a dream than like reality, and for a long time it was difficult for me to make myself believe that I was actually going to Europe. I had been born and largely reared in the lowest depths of slavery, ignorance, and poverty. In my childhood, I had suffered for want of a place to sleep, for lack of food, clothing, and shelter. I had not had the privilege of sitting down to a dining table until I was quite well grown. Luxuries had always seemed to me to be something meant for white people, not for my race. I had always regarded Europe and London and Paris much as I regard heaven. And now, could it be that I was actually going to Europe? Such thoughts as these were constantly with me. Two other thoughts troubled me a good deal. I feared that people who heard that Mrs. Washington and I were going to Europe might not know all the circumstances and might get the idea that we had become, as some might say, stuck up and were trying to show off. I recalled that from my youth I had heard it said that too often, when people of my race reached any degree of success, they were inclined to unduly exalt themselves, to try and ape the wealthy, and in so doing to lose their heads. The fear that people might think this of us haunted me a good deal. Then, too, I could not see how my conscience would permit me to spare the time from my work and be happy. It seemed mean and selfish in me to be asking a vacation while others were at work, and while there was so much that needed to be done. From the time I could remember, I had always been at work, and I did not see how I could spend 3 or 4 months in doing nothing. The fact was that I did not know how to take a vacation. Mrs. Washington had much the same difficulty in getting away, but she was anxious to go because she thought that I needed the rest. There were many important national questions bearing upon the life of the race, which were being agitated at that time, and this made it all the harder for us to decide to go. We finally gave our Boston friends our promise that we would go, and then they insisted that the date of our departure be set as soon as possible. So we decided upon May 10th. My good friend Mr. Garrison kindly took charge of all the details necessary for the success of the trip, and he, as well as other friends, gave us a great number of letters of introduction to people in France and England, and made other arrangements for our comfort and convenience abroad. Goodbyes were said at Tuskegee, and we were in New York May 9th, ready to sail the next day. Our daughter Portia, who was then studying in South Framingham, Massachusetts, came to New York to see us off. Mr. Scott, my secretary, came with me to New York in order that I might clear up the last bit of business before I left. Other friends also came to New York to see us off. Just before we went on board the steamer, another pleasant surprise came to us in the form of a letter from two generous ladies stating that they had decided to give us the money with which to erect a new building to be used in properly housing all our industries for girls at Tuskegee. We were to sail on the Friesland of the Red Star Line, and a beautiful vessel she was. We went on board just before noon, the hour of sailing. I had never before been on board a large ocean steamer, and the feeling which took possession of me when I found myself there is rather hard to describe. It was a feeling, I think, of awe mingled with delight. We were agreeably surprised to find that the captain, as well as several of the other officers, not only knew who we were, but was expecting us and gave us a pleasant greeting. There were several passengers whom we knew, including Senator Sewell of New Jersey and Edward Marshall, the newspaper correspondent. I had just a little fear that we would not be treated civilly by some of the passengers. This fear was based upon what I had heard of other people of my race, who had crossed the ocean, say about unpleasant experiences in crossing the ocean in American vessels. But in our case, from the captain down to the most humble servant, we were treated with the greatest kindness. Nor was this kindness confined to those who were connected with the steamer. It was shown by all the passengers also. There were not a few southern men and women on board, and they were as cordial as those from other parts of the country. As soon as the last goodbyes were said, and the steamer had cut loose from the wharf, the load of care, anxiety, and responsibility which I had carried for 18 years began to lift itself from my shoulders at the rate, it seemed to me, of a pound a minute. It was the first time in all those years that I had felt, even in a measure, free from care. And my feeling of relief, it is hard to describe on paper. Added to this was the delightful anticipation of being in Europe soon. It all seemed more like a dream than like a reality. Mr. Garrison had thoughtfully arranged to have us have one of the most comfortable rooms on the ship. The second or third day out, I began to sleep, and I think that I slept at the rate of 15 hours a day during the remainder of the 10 days' passage. Then it was that I began to understand how tired I really was. These long sleeps I kept up for a month after we landed on the other side. It was such an unusual feeling to wake up in the morning and realize that I had no engagements, did not have to take a train at a certain hour, did not have an appointment to meet someone or to make an address at a certain hour. How different all this was from some of the experiences that I have been through when traveling, when I have sometimes slept in 3 different beds in a single night. When Sunday came, The captain invited me to conduct the religious services, but not being a minister, I declined. The passengers, however, began making requests that I deliver an address to them in the dining saloon sometime during the voyage, and this I consented to do. Senator Sewell presided at this meeting. After 10 days of delightful weather, during which I was not seasick for a day, we landed at the interesting old city of Antwerp in Belgium. The next day after we landed happened to be one of those numberless holidays which the people of those countries are in the habit of observing. It was a bright, beautiful day. Our room in the hotel faced the main public square, and the sights there, the people coming in from the country with all kinds of beautiful flowers to sell, the women coming in with their dogs drawing large, brightly polished cans filled with milk, the people streaming into the cathedral, filled me with a sense of newness that I had never before experienced. After spending some time in Antwerp, we were invited to go with a party of a half dozen persons on a trip through Holland. This party included Edward Marshall and some American artists who had come over on the same steamer with us. We accepted the invitation and enjoyed the trip greatly. I think it was all the more interesting and instructive because we went for most of the way on one of the slow, old-fashioned canal boats. This gave us an opportunity of seeing and studying the real life of the people in the country districts. We went in this way as far as Rotterdam and later went to The Hague, where the peace conference was then in session and where we were kindly received by the American representatives. The thing that impressed itself most on me in Holland was the thoroughness of the agriculture and the excellence of the Holstein cattle. I never knew, before visiting Holland, how much it was possible for people to get out of a small plot of ground. It seemed to me that absolutely no land was wasted. It was worth a trip to Holland, too, just to get a sight of 300 or 400 fine Holstein cows grazing in one of those intensely green fields. From Holland we went to Belgium and made a hasty trip through that country, stopping at Brussels, where we visited the battlefield of Waterloo. From Belgium we went direct to Paris, where we found that Mr. Theodore Stanton, the son of Mrs. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, had kindly provided accommodations for us. We had barely got settled in Paris before an invitation came to me from the University Club of Paris to be its guest at a banquet which was soon to be given. The other guests were ex-president Benjamin Harrison and Archbishop Ireland, who were in Paris at the time. The American ambassador, General Horace Porter, presided at the banquet. My address on this occasion seemed to give satisfaction to those who heard it. General Harrison kindly devoted a large portion of his remarks at dinner to myself and to the influence of the work at Tuskegee on the American race question. After my address at this banquet, other invitations came to me, but I declined the most of them, knowing that if I accepted them all, the object of my visit would be defeated. I did, however, consent to deliver an address in the American chapel the following Sunday morning, and at this meeting General Harrison, General Porter, and other distinguished Americans were present. Later we received a formal call from the American ambassador and were invited to attend a reception at his residence. At this reception we met many Americans, among them Justices Fuller and Harlan of the United States Supreme Court. During our entire stay of a month in Paris, both the American ambassador and his wife, as well as several other Americans, were very kind to us. While in Paris, we saw a good deal of the now rather famous American Negro painter, Mr. Henry O. Tanner, whom we had formerly known in America. It was very satisfactory to find how well known Mr. Tanner was in the field of art, and to note the high standing which all classes accorded to him. When we told some Americans that we were going to the Luxembourg Palace to see a painting by an American Negro, it was hard to convince them that a Negro had been thus honored. I do not believe that they were really convinced of the fact until they saw the picture for themselves. My acquaintance with Mr. Tanner reinforced in my mind the truth, which I am constantly trying to impress upon our students at Tuskegee, and on our people throughout the country, as far as I can reach them with my voice, that any man, regardless of color, will be recognized and rewarded just in proportion as he learns to do something well, learns to do it better than someone else, however humble the thing may be. As I have said, I believe that my race will succeed in proportion as it learns to do a common thing in an uncommon manner, learns to do a thing so thoroughly that no one can improve upon what it has done, learns to make its services of indispensable value. This was the spirit that inspired me in my first effort at Hampton when I was given the opportunity to sweep and dust that schoolroom. In a degree, I felt that my whole future life depended upon the thoroughness with which I cleaned that room, and I was determined to do it so well that no one could find any fault with the job. Few people ever stopped, I found, when looking at his pictures, to inquire whether Mr. Tanner was a Negro painter, a French painter, or a German painter. They simply knew that he was able to produce something which the world wanted, a great painting, and the matter of his color did not enter into their minds. When a Negro girl learns to cook, to wash dishes, to sew, to write a book, or a Negro boy learns to groom horses, or to grow sweet potatoes, or to produce butter, or to build a house, or to be able to practice medicine as well or better than someone else, they will be rewarded regardless of race or color. In the long run, the world is going to have the best, and any difference in race, religion, or previous history will not long keep the world from what it wants. I think that the whole future of my race hinges on the question as to whether or not it can make itself of such indispensable value that the people in the town and the state where we reside will feel that our presence is necessary to the happiness and well-being of the community. No man who continues to add something to the material, intellectual, and moral well-being of the place in which he lives is long left without proper reward. This is a great human law which cannot be permanently nullified. The love of pleasure and excitement which seems in a large measure to possess the French people impressed itself upon me. I think they are more noted in this respect than is true of the people of my own race. In point of morality and moral earnestness, I do not believe that the French are ahead of my own race in America. Severe competition and the great stress of life have led them to learn to do things more thoroughly and to exercise greater economy, but time, I think, will bring my race to the same point. In the matter of truth and high honor, I do not believe that the average Frenchman is ahead of the American Negro. While so far as mercy and kindness to dumb animals go, I believe that my race is far ahead. In fact, when I left France, I had more faith in the future of the black man in America than I had ever possessed. From Paris, we went to London and reached there early in July, just about the height of the London social season. Parliament was in session, and there was a great deal of gaiety. Mr. Garrison and other friends had provided us with a large number of letters of introduction, and they had also sent letters to other persons in different parts of the United Kingdom, apprising these people of our coming. Very soon after reaching London, we were flooded with invitations to attend all manner of social functions, and a great many invitations came to me asking that I deliver public addresses. The most of these invitations I declined for the reason that I wanted to rest. Neither were we able to accept more than a small proportion of the other invitations. The Reverend Dr. Brooke Herford and Mrs. Herford, whom I had known in Boston, consulted with the American ambassador, the Honorable Joseph Choate, and arranged for me to speak at a public meeting to be held in Essex Hall. Mr. Choate kindly consented to preside. The meeting was largely attended. There were many distinguished persons present, among them several members of Parliament, including Mr. James Bryce, who spoke at the meeting. What the American ambassador said in introducing me, as well as a synopsis of what I said, was widely published in England and in the American papers at the time. Dr. and Mrs. Herford gave Mrs. Washington and myself a reception, at which we had the privilege of meeting some of the best people in England. Throughout our stay in London, Ambassador Choate was most kind and attentive to us. At the ambassador's reception, I met for the first time Mark Twain. We were the guests several times of Mrs. T. Fisher Unwin, the daughter of the English statesman Richard Cobden. It seemed as if both Mr. and Mrs. Unwin could not do enough for our comfort and happiness. Later, for nearly a week, we were the guests of the daughter of John Bright, now Mrs. Clark of Street, England. Both Mr. and Mrs. Clark, with their daughter, visited us at Tuskegee the next year. In Birmingham, England, we were the guests for several days of Mr. Joseph Sturge, whose father was a great abolitionist and friend of Whittier and Garrison. It was a great privilege to meet throughout England those who had known and honored the late William Lloyd Garrison, the Honorable Frederick Douglass, and other abolitionists. The English abolitionists with whom we came in contact never seemed to tire of talking about these two Americans. Before going to England, I had had no proper conception of the deep interest displayed by the abolitionists of England in the cause of freedom, nor did I realize the amount of substantial help given by them. In Bristol, England, both Mrs. Washington and I spoke at the Women's Liberal Club. I was also the principal speaker at the commencement exercises of the Royal College for the Blind. These exercises were held in the Crystal Palace, and the presiding officer was the late Duke of Westminster, who was said to be, I believe, the richest man in England, if not in the world. The Duke, as well as his wife and his daughter, seemed to be pleased with what I said and thanked me heartily. Through the kindness of Lady Aberdeen, my wife and I were enabled to go with a party of those who were attending the International Congress of Women, then in session in London, to see Queen Victoria at Windsor Castle, where afterward we were all the guests of Her Majesty at tea. In our party was Miss Susan B. Anthony, and I was deeply impressed with the fact that one did not often get an opportunity to see, during the same hour, two women so remarkable in different ways as Susan B. Anthony and Queen Victoria. In the House of Commons, which we visited several times, we met Sir Henry M. Stanley. I talked with him about Africa and its relation to the American Negro, and after my interview with him, I became more convinced than ever that there was no hope of the American Negro's improving his condition by emigrating to Africa. On various occasions, Mrs. Washington and I were the guests of Englishmen in their country homes, where I think one sees the Englishman at his best. In one thing, at least, I feel sure that the English are ahead of Americans, and that is that they have learned how to get more out of life. The home life of the English seems to me to be about as perfect as anything can be. Everything moves like clockwork. I was impressed, too, with the deference that the servants show to their masters and mistresses, terms which I suppose would not be tolerated in America. The English servant expects, as a rule, to be nothing but a servant, and so he perfects himself in the art to a degree that no class of servants in America has yet reached. In our country, the servant expects to become, in a few years, a master himself. Which system is preferable? I will not venture an answer. Another thing that impressed itself upon me throughout England was the high regard that all classes have for law and order, and the ease and thoroughness with which everything is done. The Englishman, I found, took plenty of time for eating as for everything else. I am not sure if, in the long run, they do not accomplish as much or more than rushing, nervous Americans do. My visit to England gave me a higher regard for the nobility than I had had. I had no idea that they were so generally loved and respected by the masses, nor had I any correct conception of how much time and money they spent in works of philanthropy, and how much real heart they put into this work. My impression had been that they merely spent money freely and had a good time. It was hard for me to get accustomed to speaking to English audiences. The average Englishman is so serious, and is so tremendously in earnest about everything, that when I told a story that would have made an American audience roar with laughter, the Englishman simply looked me straight in the face without even cracking a smile. When the Englishman takes you into his heart and friendship, he binds you there as with cords of steel, and I do not believe that there are many other friendships that are so lasting or so satisfactory. Perhaps I can illustrate this point in no better way than by relating the following incident. Mrs. Washington and I were invited to attend a reception given by the Duke and Duchess of Sutherland at Stafford House, said to be the finest house in London. I may add that I believe the Duchess of Sutherland is said to be the most beautiful woman in England. There must have been at least 300 persons at this reception. Twice during the evening, the Duchess sought us out for a conversation, and she asked me to write her when we got home and tell her more about the work at Tuskegee. This I did. When Christmas came, we were surprised and delighted to receive her photograph with her autograph on it. The correspondence has continued, and we now feel that in the Duchess of Sutherland we have one of our warmest friends. After 3 months in Europe, we sailed from Southampton in the steamship St. Louis. On this steamer, there was a fine library that had been presented to the ship by the citizens of St. Louis, Missouri. In this library, I found a life of Frederick Douglass, which I began reading. I became especially interested in Mr. Douglass's description of the way he was treated on shipboard during his first or second visit to England. In this description, he told how he was not permitted to enter the cabin, but had to confine himself to the deck of the ship. A few minutes after I had finished reading this description, I was waited on by a committee of ladies and gentlemen with the request that I deliver an address at a concert which was to be given the following evening. And yet there are people who are bold enough to say that race feeling in America is not growing less intense. At this concert, the Honorable Benjamin B. Odell, Jr., the present governor of New York, presided. I was never given a more cordial hearing anywhere. A large proportion of the passengers were Southern people. After the concert, some of the passengers proposed that a subscription be raised to help the work at Tuskegee, and the money to support several scholarships was the result. While we were in Paris, I was very pleasantly surprised to receive the following invitation from the citizens of West Virginia, and of the city near which I had spent my boyhood days. Charleston, West Virginia, May 16, 1899. Professor Booker T. Washington, Paris, France. Dear Sir, many of the best citizens of West Virginia have united in liberal expressions of admiration and praise of your worth and work, and desire that on your return from Europe you should favor them with your presence and with the inspiration of your words. We most sincerely endorse this move, and on behalf of the citizens of Charleston, extend to you our most cordial invitation to have you come to us, that we may honor you who have done so much by your life and work to honor us. We are, very truly yours, the Common Council of the City of Charleston, by W. Herman Smith, Mayor. This invitation from the City Council of Charleston was accompanied by the following. Professor Booker T. Washington, Paris, France. Dear Sir, we, the citizens of Charleston and West Virginia, desire to express our pride in you and the splendid career that you have thus far accomplished, and ask that we be permitted to show our pride and interest in a substantial way. Your recent visit to your old home in our midst awoke within us the keenest regret that we were not permitted to hear you and render some substantial aid to your work before you left for Europe. In view of the foregoing, we earnestly invite you to share the hospitality of our city upon your return from Europe and give us the opportunity to hear you and put ourselves in touch with your work in a way that will be most gratifying to yourself and that we may receive the inspiration of your words and presence. An early reply to this invitation, with an indication of the time you may reach our city, will greatly oblige. Yours very respectfully, the Charleston Daily Gazette, the Daily Mail Tribune, G.W. Atkinson, Governor, E.L. Boggs, Secretary to Governor, William M.O. Dawson, Secretary of State, L.M. La Follette, Auditor, J.R. Trotter, Superintendent of Schools, E.W. Wilson, Ex-Governor, W.A. McCorkle, Ex-Governor, John Q. Dickinson, President, Kanawha Valley Bank, L. Pritchard, President, Charleston National Bank, George S. Couch, President, Kanawha National Bank, Ed Reed, Cashier, Kanawha National Bank, George S. Laidley, Superintendent, City Schools, L. E. McWhorter, President, Board of Education, Charles K. Payne, Wholesale Merchant, and many others. This invitation, coming as it did from the City Council, the state officers, and all the substantial citizens of both races of the community where I had spent my boyhood, and from which I had gone a few years before, unknown, in poverty and ignorance, in quest of an education, not only surprised me, but almost unmanned me. I could not understand what I had done to deserve it all. I accepted the invitation, and at the appointed day was met at the railway station at Charleston by a committee headed by ex-Governor W.A. McCorkle and composed of men of both races. The public reception was held in the Opera House at Charleston. The governor of the state, the Honorable George W. Atkinson, presided, and an address of welcome was made by ex-Governor McCorkle. A prominent part in the reception was taken by the colored citizens. The Opera House was filled with citizens of both races, and among the white people were many for whom I had worked when a boy. The next day, Governor and Mrs. Atkinson gave me a public reception at the State House, which was attended by all classes. Not long after this, the colored people in Atlanta, Georgia, gave me a reception at which the governor of the state presided, and a similar reception was given me in New Orleans, which was presided over by the mayor of the city. Invitations came from many other places, which I was not able to accept. Chapter 17. Last Words. Before going to Europe, some events came into my life which were great surprises to me. In fact, my whole life has largely been one of surprises. I believe that any man's life will be filled with constant, unexpected encouragements of this kind if he makes up his mind to do his level best each day of his life, that is, tries to make each day reach as nearly as possible the high water mark of pure, unselfish, useful living. I pity the man, black or white, who has never experienced the joy and satisfaction that come to one by reason of an effort to assist in making someone else more useful and more happy. 6 months before he died, and nearly a year after he had been stricken with paralysis, General Armstrong expressed a wish to visit Tuskegee again before he passed away. Notwithstanding the fact that he had lost the use of his limbs to such an extent that he was practically helpless, his wish was gratified, and he was brought to Tuskegee. The owners of the Tuskegee Railroad, white men living in the town, offered to run a special train, without cost, out to the main station, Cheehaw, 5 miles away, to meet him. He arrived on the school grounds about 9 o'clock in the evening. Someone had suggested that we give the general a pine knot torch-like reception. This plan was carried out, and the moment that his carriage entered the school grounds, he began passing between two lines of lighted and waving fat pine wood knots held by over 1,000 students and teachers. The whole thing was so novel and surprising that the general was completely overcome with happiness. He remained a guest in my home for nearly 2 months, and although almost wholly without the use of voice or limb, he spent nearly every hour in devising ways and means to help the South. Time and time again, he said to me, during this visit, that it was not only the duty of the country to assist in elevating the Negro of the South, but the poor white man as well. At the end of his visit, I resolved anew to devote myself more earnestly than ever to the cause which was so near his heart. I said that if a man in his condition was willing to think, work, and act, I should not be wanting in furthering in every possible way the wish of his heart. The death of General Armstrong a few weeks later gave me the privilege of getting acquainted with one of the finest, most unselfish, and most attractive men that I have ever come in contact with. I refer to the Reverend Dr. Hollis B. Frissell, now the principal of the Hampton Institute and General Armstrong's successor. Under the clear, strong, and almost perfect leadership of Dr. Frissell, Hampton has had a career of prosperity and usefulness that is all that the general could have wished for. It seems to be the constant effort of Dr. Frissell to hide his own great personality behind that of General Armstrong, to make himself of no reputation for the sake of the cause. More than once I have been asked what was the greatest surprise that ever came to me. I have little hesitation in answering that question. It was the following letter, which came to me one Sunday morning when I was sitting on the veranda of my home at Tuskegee, surrounded by my wife and three children. Harvard University, Cambridge, May 28, 1896. President Booker T. Washington, my dear sir. Harvard University desires to confer on you, at the approaching commencement, an honorary degree, but it is our custom to confer degrees only on gentlemen who are present. Our commencement occurs this year on June 24th, and your presence would be desirable from about noon until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Would it be possible for you to be in Cambridge on that day? Believe me, with great regard, very truly yours, Charles W. Eliot. This was a recognition that had never in the slightest manner entered into my mind, and it was hard for me to realize that I was to be honored by a degree from the oldest and most renowned university in America. As I sat upon my veranda, with this letter in my hand, tears came into my eyes. My whole former life, my life as a slave on the plantation, my work in the coal mine, the times when I was without food and clothing, when I made my bed under a sidewalk, my struggles for an education, the trying days I had had at Tuskegee, days when I did not know where to turn for a dollar to continue the work there, the ostracism and sometimes oppression of my race, all this passed before me and nearly overcame me. I had never sought or cared for what the world calls fame. I have always looked upon fame as something to be used in accomplishing good. I have often said to my friends that if I can use whatever prominence may have come to me as an instrument with which to do good, I am content to have it. I care for it only as a means to be used for doing good, just as wealth may be used. The more I come in contact with wealthy people, the more I believe that they are growing in the direction of looking upon their money simply as an instrument which God has placed in their hand for doing good with it. I never go to the office of Mr. John D. Rockefeller, who more than once has been generous to Tuskegee, without being reminded of this. The close, careful, and minute investigation that he always makes in order to be sure that every dollar that he gives will do the most good, an investigation that is just as searching as if he were investing money in a business enterprise, convinces me that the growth in this direction is most encouraging. At 9 o'clock on the morning of June 24th, I met President Eliot, the Board of Overseers of Harvard University, and the other guests at the designated place on the university grounds for the purpose of being escorted to Sanders Theater, where the commencement exercises were to be held and degrees conferred. Among others invited to be present for the purpose of receiving a degree at this time were General Nelson A. Miles, Dr. Bell, the inventor of the Bell telephone, Bishop Vincent, and the Reverend Minot J. Savage. We were placed in line immediately behind the President and the Board of Overseers, and directly afterward, the Governor of Massachusetts, escorted by the Lancers, arrived and took his place in the line of march by the side of President Eliot. In the line, there were also various other officers and professors clad in cap and gown. In this order, we marched to Sanders Theater, where, after the usual commencement exercises, came the conferring of the honorary degrees. This, it seems, is always considered the most interesting feature at Harvard. It is not known until the individuals appear upon whom the honorary degrees are to be conferred, and those receiving these honors are cheered by the students and others in proportion to their popularity. During the conferring of the degrees, excitement and enthusiasm are at the highest pitch. When my name was called, I rose, and President Eliot, in beautiful and strong English, conferred upon me the degree of Master of Arts. After these exercises were over, those who had received honorary degrees were invited to lunch with the President. After the lunch, we were formed in line again and were escorted by the Marshal of the day, who that year happened to be Bishop William Lawrence, through the grounds where, at different points, those who had been honored were called by name and received the Harvard yell. This march ended at Memorial Hall, where the alumni dinner was served. To see over 1,000 strong men representing all that is best in state, church, business, and education, with a glow and enthusiasm of college loyalty and college pride, which has, I think, a peculiar Harvard flavor, is a sight that does not easily fade from memory. Among the speakers after dinner were President Eliot, Governor Roger Wolcott, General Miles, Dr. Minot J. Savage, the Honorable Henry Cabot Lodge, and myself. When I was called upon, I said, among other things, "It would in some measure relieve my embarrassment if I could, even in a slight degree, feel myself worthy of the great honor which you do me today. Why you have called me from the Black Belt of the South, from among my humble people, to share in the honors of this occasion, is not for me to explain. And yet, it may not be inappropriate for me to suggest that it seems to me that one of the most vital questions that touch our American life is how to bring the strong, wealthy, and learned into helpful touch with the poorest, most ignorant, and humblest, and at the same time make one appreciate the vitalizing, strengthening influence of the other. How shall we make the mansions on yon Beacon Street feel and see the need of the spirits in the lowliest cabin in Alabama cotton fields or Louisiana sugar bottoms? This problem Harvard University is solving, not by bringing itself down, but by bringing the masses up. If my life in the past has meant anything in the lifting up of my people, and the bringing about of better relations between your race and mine, I assure you from this day it will mean doubly more. In the economy of God, there is but one standard by which an individual can succeed. There is but one for a race. This country demands that every race shall measure itself by the American standard. By it, a race must rise or fall, succeed or fail, and in the last analysis, mere sentiment counts for little. During the next half century and more, my race must continue passing through the severe American crucible. We are to be tested in our patience, our forbearance, our perseverance, our power to endure wrong, to withstand temptations, to economize, to acquire and use skill, in our ability to compete, to succeed in commerce, to disregard the superficial for the real, the appearance for the substance, to be great and yet small, learned and yet simple, high and yet the servant of all." As this was the first time that a New England university had conferred an honorary degree upon a Negro, it was the occasion of much newspaper comment throughout the country. A correspondent of a New York paper said, "When the name of Booker T. Washington was called, and he arose to acknowledge and accept, there was such an outburst of applause as greeted no other name except that of the popular soldier-patriot, General Miles. The applause was not studied and stiff, sympathetic and condoling. It was enthusiasm and admiration. Every part of the audience from pit to gallery joined in, and a glow covered the cheeks of those around me, proving sincere appreciation of the rising struggle of an ex-slave and the work he has accomplished for his race." A Boston paper said, editorially, "In conferring the honorary degree of Master of Arts upon the principal of Tuskegee Institute, Harvard University has honored itself as well as the object of this distinction. The work which Professor Booker T. Washington has accomplished for the education, good citizenship, and popular enlightenment in his chosen field of labor in the South entitles him to rank with our national benefactors. The university which can claim him on its list of sons, whether in regular course or honoris causa, may be proud." It has been mentioned that Mr. Washington is the first of his race to receive an honorary degree from a New England university. This in itself is a distinction. But the degree was not conferred because Mr. Washington is a colored man, or because he was born in slavery, but because he has shown, by his work for the elevation of the people of the Black Belt of the South, a genius and a broad humanity which count for greatness in any man, whether his skin be white or black. Another Boston paper said, "It is Harvard which, first among New England colleges, confers an honorary degree upon a black man. No one who has followed the history of Tuskegee and its work can fail to admire the courage, persistence, and splendid common sense of Booker T. Washington. Well may Harvard honor the ex-slave, the value of whose services, alike to his race and country, only the future can estimate." The correspondent of the New York Times wrote, "All the speeches were enthusiastically received, but the colored man carried off the oratorical honors, and the applause which broke out when he had finished was vociferous and long-continued." Soon after I began work at Tuskegee, I formed a resolution, in the secret of my heart, that I would try to build up a school that would be of so much service to the country that the President of the United States would one day come to see it. This was, I confess, rather a bold resolution, and for a number of years I kept it hidden in my own thoughts, not daring to share it with anyone. In November 1897, I made the first move in this direction, and that was in securing a visit from a member of President McKinley's cabinet, the Honorable James Wilson, Secretary of Agriculture. He came to deliver an address at the formal opening of the Slater Armstrong Agricultural Building, our first large building to be used for the purpose of giving training to our students in agriculture and kindred branches. In the fall of 1898, I heard that President McKinley was likely to visit Atlanta, Georgia, for the purpose of taking part in the Peace Jubilee exercises to be held there to commemorate the successful close of the Spanish-American War. At this time, I had been hard at work, together with our teachers, for 18 years, trying to build up a school that we thought would be of service to the nation, and I determined to make a direct effort to secure a visit from the President and his cabinet. I went to Washington, and I was not long in the city before I found my way to the White House. When I got there, I found the waiting rooms full of people, and my heart began to sink, for I feared there would not be much chance of my seeing the President that day, if at all. But, at any rate, I got an opportunity to see Mr. J. Addison Porter, the secretary to the President, and explain to him my mission. Mr. Porter kindly sent my card directly to the President, and in a few minutes word came from Mr. McKinley that he would see me. How any man can see so many people of all kinds, with all kinds of errands, and do so much hard work, and still keep himself calm, patient, and fresh for each visitor in the way that President McKinley does, I cannot understand. When I saw the President, he kindly thanked me for the work which we were doing at Tuskegee for the interests of the country. I then told him briefly the object of my visit. I impressed upon him the fact that a visit from the chief executive of the nation would not only encourage our students and teachers, but would help the entire race. He seemed interested, but did not make a promise to go to Tuskegee for the reason that his plans about going to Atlanta were not then fully made. But he asked me to call the matter to his attention a few weeks later. By the middle of the following month, the President had definitely decided to attend the Peace Jubilee at Atlanta. I went to Washington again and saw him, with a view of getting him to extend his trip to Tuskegee. On this second visit, Mr. Charles W. Hare, a prominent white citizen of Tuskegee, kindly volunteered to accompany me to reinforce my invitation with one from the white people of Tuskegee and the vicinity. Just previous to my going to Washington the second time, the country had been excited and the colored people greatly depressed because of several severe race riots which had occurred at different points in the South. As soon as I saw the President, I perceived that his heart was greatly burdened by reason of these race disturbances. Although there were many people waiting to see him, he detained me for some time, discussing the condition and prospects of the race. He remarked several times that he was determined to show his interest and faith in the race, not merely in words, but by acts. When I told him that I thought that at that time scarcely anything would go farther in giving hope and encouragement to the race than the fact that the President of the nation would be willing to travel 140 miles out of his way to spend a day at a Negro institution, he seemed deeply impressed. While I was with the President, a white citizen of Atlanta, a Democrat and an ex-slaveholder, came into the room, and the President asked his opinion as to the wisdom of his going to Tuskegee. Without hesitation, the Atlanta man replied that it was the proper thing for him to do. This opinion was reinforced by that friend of the race, Dr. J.L.M. Curry. The President promised that he would visit our school on the 16th of December. When it became known that the President was going to visit our school, the white citizens of the town of Tuskegee, a mile distant from the school, were as much pleased as were our students and teachers. The white people of the town, including both men and women, began arranging to decorate the town and to form themselves into committees for the purpose of cooperating with the officers of our school, in order that the distinguished visitor might have a fitting reception. I think I never realized before this how much the white people of Tuskegee and vicinity thought of our institution. During the days when we were preparing for the President's reception, dozens of these people came to me and said that while they did not want to push themselves into prominence, if there was anything they could do to help or to relieve me personally, I had but to intimate it, and they would be only too glad to assist. In fact, the thing that touched me almost as deeply as the visit of the President itself was the deep pride which all classes of citizens in Alabama seemed to take in our work. The morning of December 16th brought to the little city of Tuskegee such a crowd as it had never seen before. With the President came Mrs. McKinley and all of the cabinet officers but one, and most of them brought their wives or some members of their families. Several prominent generals came, including General Shafter and General Joseph Wheeler, who were recently returned from the Spanish-American War. There was also a host of newspaper correspondents. The Alabama legislature was in session at Montgomery at this time. This body passed a resolution to adjourn for the purpose of visiting Tuskegee. Just before the arrival of the President's party, the legislature arrived, headed by the governor and other state officials. The citizens of Tuskegee had decorated the town from the station to the school in a generous manner. In order to economize in the matter of time, we arranged to have the whole school pass in review before the president. Each student carried a stalk of sugarcane with some open bowls of cotton fastened to the end of it. Following the students, the work of all departments of the school passed in review, displayed on floats drawn by horses, mules, and oxen. On these floats, we tried to exhibit not only the present work of the school, but to show the contrasts between the old methods of doing things and the new. As an example, we showed the old method of dairying in contrast with the improved methods, the old methods of tilling the soil in contrast with the new, the old methods of cooking and housekeeping in contrast with the new. These floats consumed an hour and a half of time in passing. In his address in our large new chapel, which the students had recently completed, the president said, among other things, "To meet you under such pleasant auspices, and to have the opportunity of a personal observation of your work, is indeed most gratifying. The Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute is ideal in its conception, and has already a large and growing reputation in the country, and is not unknown abroad. I congratulate all who are associated in this undertaking for the good work which it is doing in the education of its students to lead lives of honor and usefulness, thus exalting the race for which it was established. Nowhere, I think, could a more delightful location have been chosen for this unique educational experiment, which has attracted the attention and won the support even of conservative philanthropists in all sections of the country. To speak of Tuskegee without paying special tribute to Booker T. Washington's genius and perseverance would be impossible. The inception of this noble enterprise was his, and he deserves high credit for it. His was the enthusiasm and enterprise which made its steady progress possible and established in the institution its present high standard of accomplishment. He has won a worthy reputation as one of the great leaders of his race, widely known and much respected at home and abroad as an accomplished educator, a great orator, and a true philanthropist." The Honorable John D. Long, the Secretary of the Navy, said in part, "I cannot make a speech today. My heart is too full. Full of hope, admiration, and pride for my countrymen of both sections and both colors. I am filled with gratitude and admiration for their work, and from this time forward, I shall have absolute confidence in your progress and in the solution of the problem in which you are engaged. The problem, I say, has been solved. A picture has been presented today, which should be put upon canvas with the pictures of Washington and Lincoln, and transmitted to future time and generations. A picture which the press of the country should spread broadcast over the land. A most dramatic picture. And that picture is this. The President of the United States standing on this platform. On one side, the Governor of Alabama. On the other, completing the Trinity, a representative of a race only a few years ago in bondage, the colored president of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute. God bless the president under whose majesty such a scene as that is presented to the American people. God bless the state of Alabama, which is showing that it can deal with this problem for itself. God bless the orator, philanthropist, and disciple of the great master, who, if he were on earth, would be doing the same work, Booker T. Washington." Postmaster General Smith closed the address which he made with these words, "We have witnessed many spectacles within the last few days. We have seen the magnificent grandeur and the magnificent achievements of one of the great metropolitan cities of the South. We have seen heroes of the war pass by in procession. We have seen floral parades. But I am sure my colleagues will agree with me in saying that we have witnessed no spectacle more impressive and more encouraging, more inspiring for our future, than that which we have witnessed here this morning." Some days after the President returned to Washington, I received the letter which follows. Executive Mansion, Washington, December 23, 1899. Dear Sir, "By this mail, I take pleasure in sending you engrossed copies of the souvenir of the visit of the President to your institution. These sheets bear the autographs of the President and the members of the Cabinet who accompanied him on the trip. Let me take this opportunity of congratulating you most heartily and sincerely upon the great success of the exercises provided for and entertainment furnished us under your auspices during our visit to Tuskegee. Every feature of the program was perfectly executed and was viewed or participated in with the heartiest satisfaction by every visitor present. The unique exhibition which you gave of your pupils engaged in their industrial vocations was not only artistic but thoroughly impressive. The tribute paid by the President and his cabinet to your work was none too high and forms a most encouraging augury, I think, for the future prosperity of your institution. I cannot close without assuring you that the modesty shown by yourself in the exercises was most favorably commented upon by all the members of our party. With best wishes for the continued advance of your most useful and patriotic undertaking, kind personal regards, and the compliments of the season, believe me, always very sincerely yours, John Addison Porter, Secretary to the President. To President Booker T. Washington, Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, Tuskegee, Alabama. 20 years have now passed since I made the first humble effort at Tuskegee, in a broken-down shanty and an old henhouse, without owning a dollar's worth of property, and with but one teacher and 30 students. At the present time, the institution owns 2,300 acres of land, over 700 of which are under cultivation each year, entirely by student labor. There are now upon the grounds, counting large and small, 40 buildings, and all except 4 of these have been almost wholly erected by the labor of our students. While the students are at work upon the land and in erecting buildings, they are taught by competent instructors the latest methods of agriculture and the trades connected with building. There are in constant operation at the school, in connection with thorough academic and religious training, 28 industrial departments. All of these teach industries at which our men and women can find immediate employment as soon as they leave the institution. The only difficulty now is that the demand for our graduates from both white and black people in the South is so great that we cannot supply more than one half the persons for whom applications come to us. Neither have we the buildings nor the money for current expenses to enable us to admit to the school more than one half the young men and women who apply to us for admission. In our industrial teaching, we keep 3 things in mind. First, that the student shall be so educated that he shall be enabled to meet conditions as they exist now in the part of the South where he lives, in a word, to be able to do the thing which the world wants done. Second, that every student who graduates from the school shall have enough skill, coupled with intelligence and moral character, to enable him to make a living for himself and others. Third, to send every graduate out feeling and knowing that labor is dignified and beautiful, to make each one love labor instead of trying to escape it. In addition to the agricultural training which we give to young men, and the training given to our girls in all the usual domestic employments, we now train a number of girls in agriculture each year. These girls are taught gardening, fruit growing, dairying, bee culture, and poultry raising. While the institution is in no sense denominational, we have a department known as the Phelps Hall Bible Training School, in which a number of students are prepared for the ministry and other forms of Christian work, especially work in the country districts. What is equally important, each one of these students works half of each day at some industry in order to get skill and the love of work, so that when he goes out from the institution, he is prepared to set the people with whom he goes to labor a proper example in the matter of industry. The value of our property is now over $300,000. If we add to this our endowment fund, which at present is $215,000, the value of the total property is now nearly $500,000. Aside from the need for more buildings and for money for current expenses, the endowment fund should be increased to at least $500,000. The annual current expenses are now about $80,000. The greater part of this I collect each year by going from door to door and from house to house. All of our property is free from mortgage and is deeded to an undenominational board of trustees who have the control of the institution. From 30 students, the number has grown to 1,100, coming from 27 states and territories, from Africa, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Jamaica, and other foreign countries. In our departments, there are 86 officers and instructors, and if we add the families of our instructors, we have a constant population upon our grounds of not far from 1,400 people. I have often been asked how we keep so large a body of people together, and at the same time keep them out of mischief. There are 2 answers. That the men and women who come to us for an education are in earnest, and that everybody is kept busy. The following outline of our daily work will testify to this. 5 a.m., rising bell. 5:50 a.m., warning breakfast bell. 6 a.m., breakfast bell. 6:20 a.m., breakfast over. 6:20 to 6:50 a.m., rooms are cleaned. 6:50, work bell. 7:30, morning study hour. 8:20, morning school bell. 8:25, inspection of young men's toilette in ranks. 8:40, devotional exercises in chapel. 8:55, 5 minutes with the daily news. 9 a.m., classwork begins. 12, classwork closes. 12:15 p.m., dinner. 1 p.m., work bell. 1:30 p.m., classwork begins. 3:30 p.m., classwork ends. 5:30 p.m., bell to knock off work. 6 p.m., supper. 7:10 p.m., evening prayers. 7:30 p.m., evening study hours. 8:45 p.m., evening study hour closes. 9:20 p.m., warning retiring bell. 9:30 p.m., retiring bell. We try to keep constantly in mind the fact that the worth of the school is to be judged by its graduates, counting those who have finished the full course, together with those who have taken enough training to enable them to do reasonably good work, we can safely say that at least 3,000 men and women from Tuskegee are now at work in different parts of the South. Men and women who, by their own example or by direct effort, are showing the masses of our race how to improve their material, educational, and moral and religious life. What is equally important, they are exhibiting a degree of common sense and self-control, which is causing better relations to exist between the races, and is causing the Southern white man to learn to believe in the value of educating the men and women of my race. Aside from this, there is the influence that is constantly being exerted through the mothers' meeting and the plantation work conducted by Mrs. Washington. Wherever our graduates go, the changes which soon begin to appear in the buying of land, improving homes, saving money, in education, and in high moral character are remarkable. Whole communities are fast being revolutionized through the instrumentality of these men and women. 10 years ago, I organized at Tuskegee the first Negro Conference. This is an annual gathering which now brings to the school 800 or 900 representative men and women of the race who come to spend a day in finding out what the actual industrial, mental, and moral conditions of the people are and in forming plans for improvement. Out from this Central Negro Conference at Tuskegee have grown numerous state and local conferences which are doing the same kind of work. As a result of the influence of these gatherings, one delegate reported at the last annual meeting that 10 families in his community had bought and paid for homes. On the day following the annual Negro Conference, there is held the Workers' Conference. This is composed of officers and teachers who are engaged in educational work in the larger institutions in the South. The Negro Conference furnishes a rare opportunity for these workers to study the real condition of the rank and file of the people. In the summer of 1900, with the assistance of such prominent colored men as Mr. T. Thomas Fortune, who has always upheld my hands in every effort, I organized the National Negro Business League, which held its first meeting in Boston and brought together for the first time a large number of the colored men who are engaged in various lines of trade or business in different parts of the United States. 30 states were represented at our first meeting. Out of this national meeting grew state and local business leagues. In addition to looking after the executive side of the work at Tuskegee and raising the greater part of the money for the support of the school, I cannot seem to escape the duty of answering at least a part of the calls which come to me unsought to address Southern white audiences and audiences of my own race, as well as frequent gatherings in the North. As to how much of my time is spent in this way, the following clipping from a Buffalo, New York paper will tell. This has reference to an occasion when I spoke before the National Educational Association in that city. Booker T. Washington, the foremost educator among the colored people of the world, was a very busy man from the time he arrived in the city the other night from the West and registered at the Iroquois. He had hardly removed the stains of travel when it was time to partake of supper. Then he held a public levee in the parlors of the Iroquois until 8 o'clock. During that time, he was greeted by over 200 eminent teachers and educators from all parts of the United States. Shortly after 8 o'clock, he was driven in a carriage to Music Hall, and in 1 hour and a half, he made 2 ringing addresses to as many as 5,000 people on Negro education. Then Mr. Washington was taken in charge by a delegation of colored citizens, headed by the Reverend Mr. Watkins, and hustled off to a small informal reception arranged in honor of the visitor by the people of his race. Nor can I, in addition to making these addresses, escape the duty of calling the attention of the South and of the country in general, through the medium of the press, to matters that pertain to the interests of both races. This, for example, I have done in regard to the evil habit of lynching. When the Louisiana State Constitutional Convention was in session, I wrote an open letter to that body pleading for justice for the race. In all such efforts, I have received warm and hearty support from the Southern newspapers, as well as from those in all other parts of the country. Despite superficial and temporary signs which might lead one to entertain a contrary opinion, there was never a time when I felt more hopeful for the race than I do at the present. The great human law that in the end recognizes and rewards merit is everlasting and universal. The outside world does not know, neither can it appreciate the struggle that is constantly going on in the hearts of both the Southern white people and their former slaves to free themselves from racial prejudice. And while both races are thus struggling, they should have the sympathy, the support, and the forbearance of the rest of the world. As I write the closing words of this autobiography, I find myself, not by design, in the city of Richmond, Virginia, the city which only a few decades ago was the capital of the Southern Confederacy, and where about 25 years ago, because of my poverty, I slept night after night under a sidewalk. This time I am in Richmond as the guest of the colored people of the city, and came at their request to deliver an address last night to both races in the Academy of Music, the largest and finest audience room in the city. This was the first time that the colored people had ever been permitted to use this hall. The day before I came, the city council passed a vote to attend the meeting in a body to hear me speak. The state legislature, including the House of Delegates and the Senate, also passed a unanimous vote to attend in a body. In the presence of hundreds of colored people, many distinguished white citizens, the city council, the state legislature, and state officials, I delivered my message, which was one of hope and cheer. And from the bottom of my heart, I thanked both races for this welcome back to the state that gave me birth. This concludes the reading of Up From Slavery by Booker T. Washington. This book was read by Noah Waterman. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalog or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, write Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.